From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The Kabbalah has been in the news because several celebrities have been studying this tradition of Jewish mysticism. Some scholars say this popularized form of Kabbalah doesn't accurately represent the depth and complexity of the tradition. On today's Fresh Air, we talk about Kabbalah with Arthur Green, who has been studying this tradition for over 40 years and is the author of several books about Jewish mysticism. He's dean of the Rabbinical School of Hebrew College and a professor of Jewish thought at Brandeis University. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Tom Wolfe's new novel, I Am Charlotte Simmons. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Shea Stevens. Two more Marines have been killed by hostile forces near Fallujah, bringing to 10 the number killed there since Saturday. The military says the two most recent deaths occurred yesterday west of Baghdad in Anbar province, the region where 7 Marines were killed in action on Sunday. Meantime, police in Baghdad say at least one person was killed and a dozen others were injured in the second car bombing in 2 days near the so-called Green Zone. 5 Iraqi National Guardsmen were among those wounded in today's attack. 13 were killed and at least 15 were wounded in yesterday's bombing. Iraqi officials say the attacker in yesterday's incident was linked to al-Qaeda. President Bush has tapped EPA Commissioner Michael Leavitt to become the next Secretary of Health and Human Services. NPR's Don Gagne says Leavitt's nomination leaves 2 cabinet positions to fill.
Of course, a replacement for Bernie Kerik, who the president had tabbed to be the new Homeland Security Secretary, needs to be found. Kerik, of course, withdrew his name abruptly, surprisingly, this past Friday. Leavitt comes over to Health and Human Services, but his shift is really musical chairs. That leaves a vacancy at the EPA.
NPR's Don Gagne reporting. NASA Administrator Sean O'Keefe is leaving the space agency after 3 years on the job. NPR's David Kestenbaum has more.
A statement released by NASA quotes O'Keefe as saying the decision to leave was the most difficult he'd ever made, but he felt it was best for his family. O'Keefe has applied for a top job at Louisiana State University. He says he will stay on at the space agency until a successor has been named. His time at NASA has not been easy. The space shuttle fleet has been grounded since the Columbia accident 2 years ago. David Kestenbaum, NPR News, Washington.
There are reports that 2 passenger trains collided in rural northern India today, killing at least 15 people. Details are sketchy. In California, a jury is recommending that Scott Peterson be punished by death for murdering his pregnant wife, Lacey, in 2002. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The jury's decision came on the third day of deliberations, and after jurors had asked the judge to see 13 pieces of evidence, including autopsy photos and aerial photos of the site where Lacey Peterson's body had been found. Scott Peterson was convicted last month of killing his wife and, in the words of the court, baby Connor Peterson, a fetus. In a news conference, juror Rochelle Nice said there were many things that caused her to vote for the death penalty.
Scott Peterson was Lacey's husband, Connor's daddy, the one person that should have protected them. And for him to have done that.
The judge will formally sentence Peterson on February 25th, yet given the state's slow appeals process, it could take many years before the death sentence is carried out. Richard Gonzalez, NPR News, San Francisco.
You're listening to NPR News. Ohio Supreme Court has been asked to review the voting process that was used in the state's presidential election. The court motion was filed just hours before the Ohio Electoral College voted unanimously for President Bush and Vice President Cheney. Challengers, led by the Reverend Jesse Jackson, allege voting irregularities such as not having enough machines and Democrat-leaning precincts. They also claim that some voters were steered to the wrong polling sites and that the Bush campaign generally received more votes in counties that use optical scan voting machines. A popular Philippine film star and recent presidential contender has died from a stroke. NPR's Michael Sullivan has more from Manila.
Action film hero Fernando Po Jr. starred in over 200 movies, most often playing the underdog battling impossible odds. He was known in the Philippines as FPJ, or simply Da King, and was a reluctant candidate in the May presidential election against President Gloria Macapagal Arroyo. Arroyo won the contest by just 3 percentage points amid charges of fraud by the Poe campaign. President Arroyo's party denied the charges, but Poe refused to concede. After his death, President Arroyo praised Poe as a good man worthy of the people's prayers. He was admitted to the hospital on Sunday, complaining of dizziness. After hosting a dinner party for friends, Poe was 65. Michael Sullivan, NPR News, Manila.
Federal Reserve policymakers meet later today to consider interest rates. Analysts say it's likely they will raise the funds rate a quarter point. On the Tokyo Stock Exchange today, the Nikkei average was up 126 points yesterday on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials gained 95 points. The Nasdaq rose 20. I'm Shea Stevens, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, dedicated to advancing entrepreneurship across America, on the web at kauffman.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Kabbalah has been in the news because several celebrities have been studying this tradition of Jewish mysticism. Some scholars have mixed feelings about the Kabbalah's new popularity, saying that pop Kabbalah doesn't accurately represent the depth and complexity of this tradition. We invited a scholar who has been studying Kabbalah for over 40 years. Arthur Green is dean of the Hebrew College Rabbinical School. He's on leave from his position as a professor of Jewish thought at Brandeis University and is former president of the Reconstructionist Rabbinical College. He's the author of several books about Jewish mysticism. The latest are Ehiya, A Kabbalah for Tomorrow, and A Guide to the Zohar. The Zohar is the medieval compendium of Jewish mystical texts. Green writes, Kabbalah teaches that there is a secret unity of being hidden within the multiplicity and diversity of life. I asked him to introduce us to Kabbalah.
Kabbalah is the ancient Jewish mystical doctrine. It's a kind of theosophy or a kind of mystical way of understanding the structure of the universe. Kabbalah first emerges in writings around the 12th century, and a great literature of Kabbalah was created in the centuries after that. It's a way of seeing the universe completely in the structure of God. The Kabbalists are rather traditional Jews in practice, but their theology is quite radical. They believe that God is the underlying structure of being. Scratch the surface of the world, and you will discover the deep inner structure, which is God, so that God underlies and is present in all things. It is that kind of, you might call it, theosophical mysticism or mystical contemplation of the nature of being that is the essence of Kabbalah.
And that idea that scratch the surface of anything and it reveals God is also connected to the Kabbalistic understanding of creation.
That's right. The relationship between God and the world, you see, is not the relationship of creator and creature, the way it generally is seen in Western religion, but rather is the relationship of surface appearance and deep structure. So you enter, God flows into being, God flows into the world. So therefore, if you uncover the surface appearance of all things, whether it's the world or the tradition, the Torah, by the way, you will discover that inner underlying presence of God.
Isn't there a Kabbalistic story about creation being basically a vessel that's cracked open?
What you're thinking of is the story of the breaking of the vessels, when the divine light was sent into the world, when the divine energy radiated into physical being. It was so bright that physical being couldn't stand it. So the vessels in which the divine light was sent forth broke upon entering the atmosphere, we would say in our terms, and shattered into 1,000 pieces. And then the light of God came to be scattered through the world in the form of sparks. We have to redeem those sparks. We have to uncover the sparks, which are hidden by the shards of the broken vessels. But those sparks of light can be found everywhere. The point is, you never know where a spark of divine light is to be found. So you work your way through life by uncovering the shards and lifting up the sparks and bringing them back to their source.
Now, I think studying Kabbalah was supposed to be reserved for men, married men, educated men, over 40. Why?
Well, it certainly was. Kabbalah, you have to understand, was a kind of elite science. And in the Middle Ages, it was seen as a science. And the idea that Kabbalah study was dangerous was well known already in ancient times. The Talmud tells a frightening story, for example, of a young boy who meditated on the first chapter of Ezekiel, which is the great vision of the divine carriage, which becomes then the basis of a lot of Kabbalistic thought. And a thunderbolt came out of heaven and struck him, which means, of course, that he went mad or became deranged somehow. There is something about abstract contemplation of the nature of being, the nature of God, for people who take it very seriously and aren't emotionally mature enough to handle it, that can be dangerous. So the idea that you're married, that you have studied the Talmud already, which is a very grounded, legal-type, earthbound study, these things hold you down enough so that you'll be able to enter flights of imagination and flights of fancy and not be carried away, not be destroyed. Women were indeed excluded from it because the Jewish religious language was largely shared among men who had access to education that women didn't have in pre-modern times. But there's a popular form of Kabbalah known as Hasidism, which has its roots in a revival movement in the 18th century. And Hasidism was quite controversial in its day because it sought to give the secrets of Kabbalah to ordinary, unlettered people. The great rabbis of the day opposed it, but ultimately Hasidism won that victory.
Now, wasn't there also a prohibition against studying Kabbalah because of the erotic imagery in it?
Well, that was part of the idea, yes. You see, you want to talk to human beings about intimacy. How do we understand intimacy? What's the language of intimacy that we know best? How do you say God is closer to you than your own heart? You talk about the relationships of men and women. You talk about human intimacy. That's what we know. But I think that Judaism became, especially in the Middle Ages, a bit afraid of that erotic imagery. The imagery of Eros didn't come into the prayer book, for example. In the prayer book, which most Jews know, God is regularly described as father and king, but almost never as lover. It took the Kabbalists to bring the language of lover and spouse back into the vocabulary of Judaism, and when they did so, it was in an esoteric context. You didn't say that to everybody because people might misunderstand it. There was always a fear of cheapening, that somebody would degrade the relationship with God by getting a cheap kick out of it. And so they were careful not to spread that kind of language to too many people.
I hope it doesn't sound like I'm asking you this to get a cheap kick, but is an example of the erotic language that is used in the Zohar?
Oh, there is a wide variety. The elements of God in the Zohar contain both male and female, and she has to be aroused from her slumber in order to be ready to be united with her spouse. And the faithful of Israel, as they pray through the Shekhinah, through this feminine presence, stir the waters within her to arouse her so that she awakens her lover and he becomes aroused to come to her and enter her in perfect union, and then all the worlds flow together and the divine bounty comes down into this world through the union of male and female, which is described in completely sexual terms, in coital terms. He enters her and brings the blessings of divine grace to her and so on. You couldn't imagine more fully erotic language, though always, of course, very much in a sacred context. By the way, the Kabbalists who use this erotic language at the same time are quite extreme in their prohibitions around sexual behavior among human beings. Even within the Jewish tradition, they tended to take the most extremely ascetic views, while their spiritual life or spiritual fantasy life was filled with erotic imagery. It's a very interesting paradox.
Now, how does this, Kabbalistic view of the male and the female affect the more earthly understanding of, like, men and women's roles, gender roles? Because, you mentioned Hasidism earlier as being a kind of an approach to Kabbalah and mysticism. But in the Hasidic world today, anyways, role models for men and women are very, very tightly defined.
Yes, all of Kabbalah was created within a traditional Jewish society, primarily in the Near East, by the way, where the role of women was very much subservient. And it was created primarily by men and for the religious imaginations of men. Women generally did not read the Kabbalistic texts. However, the Kabbalist has an obligation, not only a Jewish legal obligation, but a spiritual obligation, to enter into the active union with his wife in a holy way. And that act, which they did ideally on Friday night, which was the time of the Holy Sabbath when the cosmic forces also united, that act was a kind of earthly reenactment of something going on in the divine sphere. And therefore, the act of physical union becomes an act of spiritual union as well. Were the women ever told this? Were the women full participants in this, or was this just something in the minds of their husbands? We have rare documentation about that. There's one text I treasure very much from the city of Tzfat, of Safed in Israel in the 16th century, which says that on Friday afternoons, as the Sabbath began, men and women, husbands and wives, would go together into the ritual bath to prepare themselves so that their minds would be dedicated to the same place, and they would therefore bring forth holy souls in their act of union. That's a rare example, I would say, of a sense that men and women were part of this enterprise together. But that is more the exception than the rule, to be sure, in classical Jewish practice. As people are rediscovering this material today, of course, one of the first questions you ask is, now that women are studying this material alongside men and together with men, how will the nature of the symbolism have to change and evolve? And I'm sure it will.
My guest is Arthur Green. He's dean of the Hebrew College Rabbinical School and author of several books about Kabbalah, the tradition of Jewish mysticism. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Arthur Green. He's dean of the Hebrew College Rabbinical School and author of several books about Kabbalah, the tradition of Jewish mysticism. Why do you think that Judaism is such a kind of book-oriented or scholarly-oriented religion?
It has been that way for a very long time. It was actually the Muslims who first referred to the Jews as the people of the book. And they were very accurate in that description. Judaism, remember, is a religion that says the word of God, the presence of God, comes to us in the form of word, comes to us in the Torah. In Christianity, the word becomes flesh in the person of Jesus. In Judaism, the word remains word. And therefore, involvement with God is involvement with language, involvement with words. Remember, we are the people who have a mythology that God created the world through speaking. Other ancient peoples talked about how the gods copulated and created the world, or God took dust and created the world. In the legend of Genesis, God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. Words are infinitely important in the Jewish spiritual mentality, and I think that has everything to do with such diverse outcomes as the nature of Kabbalah and the psyche of modern Jews, who are very much, even if alienated from tradition, very often people of words, people who are close to plays with language and deeper understandings of language. That's very typical of what you might call Jewish mentality.
There are many ways in which the Kabbalah's imagery and its comprehension of life and God is different from the Hebrew Bibles, the Old Testament. Let's look at some of those ways. You mentioned that the idea of God creating the heaven and earth in 7 days, as described in the Bible, is not something that the Kabbalists believe. The Kabbalistic literature also talks about angels and demons struggling. What are those stories like, and where do they come from?
Well, please understand, the Kabbalist would never say that he doesn't believe in God creating the world in 7 days. Of course he believes it, but you have to understand it in a deeper way. The 7 days stand for something. The 7 days represent here 7 aspects of the divine self, and each of them is manifest in a certain energy of God, and those energies are each referred to as a day. Therefore, the temporal language of 7 days really is symbolic of something that transcends time and is a reflection of the inner nature of the Godhead. You see, there is never a rejection of the prior tradition. There is rather a reinterpretation and adapting of the prior tradition. But the Kabbalists are very much concerned with what I would call levels of consciousness. That's really the key to understanding Kabbalah. The mind has many levels of consciousness that can be present at once. And you need to move from one level of mind to a deeper one, and then to yet a deeper one beyond that. One of those would be called by the Kabbalists the world of the angels. Now, they portray these worlds in vertical terms. They say it's our physical world. There's a world above it, which is the world of the angels. There's a world beyond that, which is the world in the present, in which the presence of God dwells. But I have come to understand all of that vertical language, what I call the vertical metaphor in religion. God lives up there in the heavens and we live down here on earth. I've come to understand all of that vertical language as better interpreted internally. You're really not talking about a journey up. You're talking about a journey inward, into deeper levels of the mind. So as you enter into a certain deeper level of mind, you feel what I would call a sense of angelic presence. You sense the glory. You, as it were, hear the angelic chorus singing holy, holy, holy to God, which is the essential act of the angels, proclaiming divine holiness. And it's really a way of talking about opening up deeper levels of mind to religious perception. And that, in some sense, is what the Kabbalistic enterprise is all about. No. Am I being too metaphysical here? Am I going?
Well,
I
think that would be hard
far?
To avoid, wouldn't it be? Being metaphysical when talking
please,
about mystical practice.
Please tell me if you think I'm being too abstract for the listener or taking
well,
this
well,
to
well,
somehow
let
too
me,
high a level.
No, let me say something here. I think, you know, it's such a very kind of metaphoric and scholarly and historical subject, the subject of Kabbalah, the Jewish approach to mysticism, and yet it's become a kind of popularized, almost self-help approach for a lot of people now. I mean, we read about in all the, you know, People magazine kind of places about, you know, Madonna, Barbara Streisand, I don't know if she still is, but was studying Kabbalah, you know, other celebrities, I think Elizabeth Taylor. So, you know, it's hard to kind of figure out from what you're saying, what makes this like the pop religion of the moment.
Yes, it's hard for me to understand sometimes.
Or the pop practice of the moment, yeah.
It's hard for me to understand that sometimes too, Terry. I marvel at it because most of the people involved in this pop practice have a little idea of what Kabbalah is really about and have little appreciation of the profundity of it. I'm afraid the word Kabbalah has become a popular word and it's used by people who want to market a kind of a self-help and self-appreciation approach to life with a thin veneer of Kabbalistic language over it, and also using what I consider some of the less attractive aspects of the Kabbalistic tradition, that is to say, a certain amount of belief in the power of holy men, the power of blessings, the power of holy objects. That to me that's always accompanied the Kabbalistic tradition, but I consider that to be the more trivial or superficial form of Kabbalah. And it's precisely the kind of thing that moderns shouldn't be attracted to and that thinking modern people would be turned away from. And it's that very aspect of Kabbalah, belief in holy men, touching holy books, saying, reciting holy letters, even though you don't understand them. It's that kind of thing that has been marketed as a kind of pop approach to Kabbalah. And I think it has detracted from the serious adventure of entering into Kabbalah for those who are ready to make the deeper commitment. I don't think it's been helpful. Well, it's very hard to know because on the one hand, I fully agree that I want to make this tradition more accessible to people. It has been kept too inaccessible and too hidden away. In some ways, you understand when Jews entered the modern world about 200 years ago, they were embarrassed by the mystical tradition and sought to turn aside from it. They said, that's not mainstream Judaism. Now people are trying to reclaim it for the mainstream, and that's very positive. The question of how to reclaim it and make it accessible without watering it down and making it trivial is really the question before us.
When I interviewed Madonna, something that we got a lot of reaction to, I had asked her if she had or had planned to convert to Judaism now that she's studying Kabbalah, and she said, oh no, and she doesn't. She said she didn't see Kabbalah as necessarily related to the Jewish religion, that it existed independent of that. And I was wondering your reaction to that, that you saw it more as a kind of general philosophy than as a part of Jewish religion.
She's not completely wrong, I have to say. Though Kabbalah was created completely within Judaism, there has been serious interest in Kabbalah on the part of Christians for something like 400 years. Already in the 16th century, people were having Kabbalistic books translated into Latin so that non-Jews could study them. And the whole Western occultist tradition, that which is known as theosophy and the kinds of things you find in occult bookstores, Madame Blavatsky's Theosophical Society and so on, all of that is based on a partial knowledge of Kabbalah. So there have been non-Jews interested in Kabbalah for a very long time, and in some ways Madonna is within that tradition, and you can't deny the legitimacy of that. That's all right. Kabbalah is a kind of philosophy that should be accessible to non-Jews as well as Jews. The problem is that the symbolic language of Kabbalah cannot really be appreciated unless you know the forms of Judaism. And I would say, unless you are an insider to those forms, you can't really understand what the language of the Kabbalistic secrets is if you're not privy to the inner language of Judaism.
When you talk about Kabbalistic secrets, what do you mean?
The Kabbalistic way of saying that everything we encounter, whether in nature or in Scripture, is a way to come into the presence of God.
Mm-hmm.
You can find the presence of God everywhere if you can somehow unlock the puzzle of what it means to encounter that which is before you.
Arthur Green is the dean of the Hebrew College Rabbinical School. His books include A Guide to the Zohar and Ehiya, A Kabbalah for Tomorrow. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, publisher of Tree, a new vision of the American forest by photographer James Balog. Available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Delacorte Press, publisher of Da Vinci Decoded, discovering the spiritual secrets of Leonardo's seven principles by Michael J. Gelb. And from Starbucks, collecting books and toys at neighborhood locations for this year's Holiday Angels Joy Drive. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more on the Jewish mystical tradition of Kabbalah and why in Judaism God is unnameable. We continue our conversation with theologian Arthur Green. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Tom Wolfe's new novel, I Am Charlotte Simmons. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Arthur Green. He's the author of several books about the tradition of Jewish mysticism known as Kabbalah. His latest books are Ehiyeh, A Kabbalah for Tomorrow, and A Guide to the Zohar. The Zohar is the medieval compendium of mystical Jewish texts. Green is dean of the Hebrew College Rabbinical School and is on leave from his position as professor of Jewish thought at Brandeis University. One of the beliefs in Judaism is that God's name is unknowable or unsayable.
Yes.
How is it said as a substitute for what you can't say?
Well, there are several ways of saying that because there are substitutes of substitutes. The name, the four-letter name of God, the Hebrew letters Yod Hey Vav Hey, we're not supposed to pronounce. We really don't know how they are pronounced. They are mistransliterated as Jehovah. That's the name of God that comes in English, but that's
or Yahweh.
That's just a misreading. Yes, but exactly how that name was originally pronounced, we don't know. And the tradition says that only the high priest, as he entered into the Holy of Holies on the Day of Atonement, was allowed to pronounce that name aloud. And when he pronounced that name, all the people in the courtyard would fall on their faces because they were so moved by hearing the great name of God. So we don't know what that name is supposed to sound like. We substitute for it the word Adonai, which means my Lord, in prayer. When we use the name of God in prayer, we don't really say the name of God, the four-letter name. We say Adonai, my Lord, instead of it. But in conversation, we're not even supposed to say that. So pious Jews say Hashem. They just say the name. Blessed is God, the name. And you are supposed to then meditate on the name, think of the name, as you say that circumlocution for it. The idea is, of course, that that the name of God is somehow the essence of God. If you understand the name, you will understand what God is. Those four letters, by the way, those four letters, Yod Heh Vav Heh, the name of God, really come from the verb to be. They're a kind of impossible configuration of the verb to be. It's as though the name of God were really saying is, was, will be all at once. It's past, present, and future all at once. And it means something like that which transcends time, that which is, was, and will be all in the same moment. That's really what the mysterious name of God means in Hebrew. And the Bible already knows that. The Bible already understands the name that way.
You know, as you've been describing, in the Kabbalistic vision, everything is God. Everything in the universe is a manifestation of God. And then, of course, the obvious question is, well, if everything's a manifestation of God, how do you account for evil, or is there no evil? Or so let me ask you that impossible question, which you couldn't possibly answer, but maybe you can begin to say something about how Kabbalistic thought handles that one.
If I resolve the problem of evil for you, then we will have an indeed
we got
successful
a few minutes.
Conversation.
Give it a shot.
Well, let's, in talking about evil from the point of view of Kabbalah, first let me distinguish two things. Evil is not the same as tragedy. There are things that happen in this world, disease, natural disasters, accidents, terrible things that happen to people, which are very sad but are not evil. Some people think the problem of evil is about why do the innocent get cancer or why do children die of starvation. Children dying of starvation might be evil if there are people who have excesses of food, like us Americans, and don't share it with them. That you might call evil. But evil is a human act. Evil involves human malice. Human malice, human flagrant disregard for the needs of others, lack of caring, wickedness. That's what I call evil. And evil only exists within the human realm. I don't know evil in nature. Evil exists within the human realm. The question is, if we human beings are indeed the image of God, which our tradition says, and we contain the divine soul within us, how do we become evil? Why is the possibility of evil there in human beings? Now, you have to understand that I'm a modern person. And though I'm very much a student of Kabbalah and attracted to Kabbalah, I also believe, for example, in evolution. So I turn the question of evil toward the evolution of species and say, why did it have to be that we had to evolve in a struggle that was so much dog-eat-dog, there was so much competition among species that was so aggressively patterned? Why did it have to be that we in order to stand today on top of the mound of evolutionary mound of corpses, where all the species that weren't as smart or weren't as beautiful have died out, and other species came to replace them, why did evolution have to happen in that aggressive, competitive way? That's what I don't understand. If I blame God for some aspect of evil, I think it's for that aspect of human nature, for the aggression and the violence that we discover inside human beings. Now, where does that aggression and violence come from? From my point of view, it comes mostly from our fears and the defenses we build up around ourselves because we are frightened in this world. In the language of those defenses, often externalized, we accuse other people of being our enemies, of being dangerous, of being out to get us. And then we kind of build fortresses against them. Some of those fortresses contain stereotypes and reasons for hating them. So we hate them because they're Jews or because they're black or because they're gay or because they're different or because they're something else. And we then turn all our potential for human bitterness against them.
Well, I don't know if the Kabbalists have an answer for this, but the Kabbalists believe that God is in everything. You know, beneath the surface, you will find God in everything. So
even in the soul of the greatest sinner, by the way.
Okay, but the premise of this mystical belief is that it's hidden, and it takes a lot of discipline and prayer and study and understanding and years and years and years to see this hidden manifestation of God that is beneath the surface of everything. So, I mean, another question would be, why does it need to be so hidden? How would Kabbalists answer that?
There were two Hasidic masters who were asked, what does it mean to be a Hasid? What's the real work of Hasidism? One of them said, a Hasid is a person who understands that all is God. All is God. That's the essence of Hasidism. That's the essential teaching. Everything else is commentary. Another one was asked, what does it mean to be a Hasid? He said, to work on yourself. Working on yourself is what it's all about. Now, if you can ask the question, if all is God, what's the work? Why isn't this just sort of a Timothy Leary tune in, turn on, drop out? Why do you have to work at it? What's the struggle? All is God, but it's all hidden. And it's all hidden because people aren't prepared for the great light that is contained in that insight that all is God. We are meant to live in this world. We're meant to remain creatures of this world, to live in the body, to produce new generations, to raise children, to teach, to pass on a tradition. In order to do those things, we have to sustain ourselves and therefore work in the world and earn money in order to put bread on the table. All those kinds of things require us to be very earthly creatures. And we couldn't do that if we saw the great light that's contained in all is God. We wouldn't stay here. We would climb the mountaintop perhaps and go there. We would retreat into a kind of lost place of ecstasy. And that's not what we're supposed to do in the world. We are wanted to be in this world and to continue life. And therefore it has to be kept hidden, and yet it has to be revealed for those of us who seek it with all our energies. One of the Hasidic masters says that God has done us the favor of making the divine presence absolutely invisible to us until we turn the full light of all of our resources on it, and then we can find it.
You know, in Buddhism, there's a concept of enlightenment. And, you know, you meditate, you study Zen koans, you do all kinds of things, and it's a kind of path to pursuing enlightenment. And until you've reached that state, you are more caught in earthliness and in being bound to the more trivial aspects of life. And I'm wondering, like, when you study Kabbalah, is there a similar notion that there is this point where you've reached enlightenment and the presence of God beneath the surface of things becomes more clear? Is there this kind of level that some people reach and other people don't?
No, I can say rather clearly the Jewish tradition doesn't believe in that. The Jewish mystics talk about moments of great understanding, but even the person who has reached the most profound levels can fall and can have moments of smallness or moments of ordinary mind where all of those insights go away and have to be discovered again. The image of Isaac redigging the wells that his father Abraham had dug, the wells became stuffed up and he had to redig them, becomes very important in the discussions of this. There is no sense of permanent enlightenment, and from there on you can never sin or you can never misperceive God. On the contrary, there you climb the mountain, you get to the heights of Mount Sinai, but then there are also valleys and ordinary days when you lose that consciousness. And that seems to be the pattern that the Jewish experience generally talks about. It may be because we were not a monastic tradition. We didn't have monks who then retreated into the mountaintop. They had the answer. But it rather became moments of enlightenment and moments of ordinary mind go back and forth. The life flow, the life force ebbs and flows, the Hasidic masters like to say. There's an energy of God. There's a life force that surges into you. But it comes and goes.
My guest is Arthur Green. He's dean of the Hebrew College Rabbinical School and author of several books about Kabbalah, the tradition of Jewish mysticism. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Arthur Green, and he's dean of the Rabbinical School of Hebrew College and professor of Jewish thought at Brandeis University. We're talking about Kabbalah, which is the Jewish approach to a mystical understanding of the world, and he's written extensively about Kabbalah. Now, one of the things you've done was write an introduction for a new translation of the Zohar, the main text of Kabbalistic thinking. The translation was done by Daniel Matt, and I want to read something that he's said about your work. He said that you've rescued Kabbalah from fundamentalists on the one hand and from faddists on the other. Now, we've talked a little bit about how Kabbalah has become a fad. What is the fundamentalist approach to Kabbalah?
Yes, there is a reading of Kabbalah that understands it all literally, that sees the structure of the universe that I mentioned. The structure is called the Ten Sfirot, or the Ten Primal Numbers, the Ten Manifestations of Divine Energy. It understands all of these things literally. In my book, A Guide to the Zohar, which is the longer version of the introduction to Matt's work, I try to spell out how this has to be understood as metaphor. And metaphoric understanding and literal understanding are not the same thing. The traditional Kabbalist doesn't know the distinction between them very well and understands that both the biblical text and also the text of the Zohar as being absolutely literally true. In a certain way, you have to say that Kabbalah is a form of medieval science, something like alchemy or astrology. And those, of course, were disproven by experimental science at the beginning of the 17th or 18th centuries and have been kind of relics of history ever since then. If you look at Kabbalah literally, I think you have to see it as an interesting historic relic. The question is, did this medieval science have some deep insight, contain some deep insight into the nature of the human mind? If I want to study the origins of matter at this point, I would probably turn to a physicist rather than a Kabbalist. But if I want to understand the intricacies of the human mind and the nature of human consciousness, I might very well turn to the Kabbalists along with some other mystics because they spent many centuries involved in uncovering the deeper levels of human mind.
How did you first start studying mysticism?
Well, I was a 20-year-old college senior. I had been through a highly orthodox period in my own religious life, a highly orthodox Judaism. I had rejected it and decided I didn't believe in God and had become a secularist for a while. But I discovered when I was about 20 that even though I no longer believed literally as I once had, I was a deeply religious person, and my questions were spiritual questions. I was fortunate. I was an undergraduate at Brandeis University. There was a wonderful professor named Alexander Altman, of sainted memory. He was a British professor, a German Jewish professor, came from England to the United States, I believe, in 1958 or 59, and he taught the very first course on Kabbalah that was taught anywhere in a North American university. And all of us, I was a student in that first class, and all of us who study Kabbalah here in America in the university are Altman students, and so he was a great influence. A dear friend and mentor is Rabbi Zalman Schachter, who was raised as a Lubavitch Hasid and left the world of Lubavitch and brought the world of Hasidism and Kabbalah to many people outside that closed universe, and I studied with him. But it was primarily by reading the texts on my own. I fell in love, Terry, I fell in love with the literature of Kabbalah and with the religious language of Kabbalah when I was a young man. I've been living in that romance for more than 40 years now. You know, for us Jews, 40-year journeys are significant because it's like 40 years wandering through the wilderness. So these 40 years I have lived with that language and have found that it is the language of my own soul and have developed my own spiritual journey around the love of that language and the love of the Kabbalistic texts, which I have now taught to several generations of students.
You're the dean of the Rabbinical School of Hebrew College and a professor of Jewish thought at Brandeis University. You're immersed in the scholarly texts of Judaism. From your point of view, what do you make of how religion seems to have entered politics in a new way or in a larger way than before, and how many voters reported that, you know, quote, values were the most important issues for them. What's your take on this?
I'm both heartened and disturbed by it, Terry. I'm glad to hear people are concerned about values, and I'm glad to hear that people are asking religious questions in our society. America is a deeply religious society, and that's something that hasn't gone away, and I'm not terribly surprised by it. However, I'm very upset that people think of having values applying only to the right wing. People who are liberal religious teachers, like myself, I consider myself religious liberal, and I'm not at all ashamed of that word, we too have values. We have very deep values. Values, for example, about every human being created in the image of God. That's an absolute value. And because each human being is in the image of God and each human being is unique, you can't apply generalizations, this is permitted and this is forbidden, to human situations. You can't judge a person, the Talmud says, until you stand in that person's place. That's a value. That's an absolute value. That's a religious value. Caring for each individual in his, her own terms. So when you come to something like gay marriage, for example, or when you come to many of the difficult issues being decided today, I think it's absolutely wrong and it's frightening to hear people say that only the right has values. Those of us on the religious left also have very deeply held values. We have to make that clear. And those values aren't values that shift in the wind, as some people tried to say in this last election. Those are very seriously held value positions. And we obviously have to make those clearer to people and make those more apparent. Because the idea that only the far right, only ultra-conservatives have values is a complete distortion. On the contrary, I feel that many of the claims of value on the right are in fact masking other kinds of self-interest.
We're recording this interview during Hanukkah. What does that holiday mean to you?
Well, it's a time of light. Remember, Hanukkah is a festival of lights. It historically commemorates the victory of the Maccabees over the Hellenists, over the Seleucid Empire that tried to outlaw Judaism some 21 or 2200 years ago, I guess. But in fact, it is rooted in an earlier festival, probably, that celebrates light in the winter. There are times of darkness that people go through, political times of darkness, spiritual times of darkness, times of personal crisis in their lives that lead them into darkness. The idea that in a time of darkness you set forth candles and begin adding lights and you add more light every night. Hillel taught that you add another light to the menorah every night to show that in times of greatest darkness we perform the act of adding light to the world and the light increases until it becomes the final night, a full light, a full set of lights. It's we who have the responsibility to light the candles. It's we who have the responsibility to bring light into a dark world. That, I think, is its real message.
Well, Arthur Green, I wish you a happy Hanukkah, and I thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. A happy Hanukkah to you and to one and all.
Arthur Green is the dean of the Hebrew College Rabbinical School. His books include A Guide to the Zohar and Ehiyeh, A Kabbalah for Tomorrow. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews Tom Wolfe's new novel. This is Fresh Air. In his long and controversial writing career, Tom Wolfe has lampooned the posturings of the radical chic and the Black Panthers, investigated the origins of the U.S. space program, and excoriated, in fiction, the money culture of the go-go 80s in Manhattan. Along the way, he's helped create what's known today as the genre of new journalism and introduced phrases like the right stuff into our language. Now in his latest book, Wolfe casts a satiric eye on college life in the new millennium. Book critic and college professor Maureen Corrigan gives Wolfe's effort an A.
Tom Wolfe would surely be pleased to know that a student reviewer in one of my university's newspapers has deemed his new novel to be a true-to-life and colorful account of what an undergraduate education circa 2004 entails. But the parents of that reviewer and those of her fellow undergraduates would probably be appalled. I Am Charlotte Simmons weighs in at almost 700 pages, approximately 580 of which are devoted to inspired riffs on binge drinking and indiscriminate rutting. The key detail that Wolfe dramatizes about this generation of elite students is that they're never alone. They've worked in groups throughout their school years, and when not in the physical company of others, these students are glued to their cell phones. They defecate in groups in the co-ed dorm bathrooms and fornicate in groups on their dorm beds. Wolfe envisions today's privileged college students as a pack of ultra-cool, sarcastic, and randy herd animals that play well with others. In fact, that's about all they do is play, in every sense of the word, including the hip sexual one. It would be easy to preemptively poo-poo I Am Charlotte Simmons as an old fogey's very funny rant against the immorality of today's young, or alternately, as an old fogey's softcore frat fantasy about free love and free-flowing beer. But Wolfe, as he's always done in his great non-fictional and fictional social satires, aims not just to entertain, but also to thoughtfully dissect the codes of behavior and beliefs of a foreign culture. That culture, in this case, is the lofty collegiate world of DuPont University, constructed out of bits of ivy and granite borrowed from both Duke and the University of Pennsylvania. DuPont's hallowed halls swing open one autumn to admit a nobody on scholarship. Charlotte Simmons is a brainy, religious, nice girl who's the pride of her tiny town in the Blue Ridge Mountains. Charlotte's higher education begins the day she moves into her dorm room with her devout mama and daddy in tow and meets her roommate, an anorectic, world-weary Groton grad named Beverly, who's already looking to hook up with members, any members, of the lacrosse team, and who, when she gets lucky, will regularly sexile Charlotte from their dorm room throughout the school term. Beverly's father is, of course, a DuPont alum, as well as the CEO of a Boston insurance company called Cotton Mather. Charlotte's father has been searching for a good job ever since the local Tom McCann factory closed shop and moved to Mexico. the brilliant, cringe-making scene where the two young women and their respective parents adjourn to lunch at the downscale Sizzlin' Skillet restaurant is a must-read for anyone who wants to learn about direct and indirect signifiers of class in America. What follows, because this is a Tom Wolfe novel after all, are roughly 10 major and a zillion minor plot lines that gleefully intersect. Although Wolfe breaks with convention in having his up-from-the-working-class pilgrim be a woman, he can't quite dodge the literary cliché of making his heroine beautiful, so she's pursued by three different species of DuPont male: a basketball star, a self-anointed intellectual, and a preppy named Hoyt Thorpe. As we drift through their collegiate subworlds, the word-drunk Wolf never lets pass an opportunity to dramatize big issues, like the fate of feminism on campus, the triumph of pop culture over high art, and the ultimate goal of a college education. Much of his social commentary is conveyed through his Walt Whitman-like style of cataloging things: the high-tech gadgets littering a student desk, the rap lyrics blaring from dorm CD players. Here, for instance, is part of a description of a strobe-lit frat party bacchanal that Charlotte wanders into. Charlotte could see arms and hands flashing, a whole mob of people dancing on a big terrace enclosed by glass. Next to a wall near the band, faces of a boy and girl who were dancing on top of a table. Their faces bobbed, flashed on and off, light, dark, in slices. Their arms were flailing in slices. Their legs were shimmying in slices, but they were joined at the pelvis. Their pelvic saddles bucked and reared in slices, but never parted. Gradually, Charlotte's eyes adjusted to the phenomenon, and she could see there were couples everywhere on the floor, dancing that way. Hoyt put his arm around Charlotte and said, "You want to dance?" Well, no, Charlotte doesn't, but neither does she want to spend 4 years in solitary. If Wolfe's worldview were as Dickensian as the scope of his plot and his zest for language, Charlotte would emerge from this descent into the maelstrom called an elite university education with her sense of identity intact. But Wolfe is too much a rueful social realist for fairy tales. He knows there's a price to be paid for educating oneself away from one's origins, even if the education itself isn't all that it's cracked up to be.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Tom Wolfe's new novel, I Am Charlotte Simmons. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from TIAA Cref, providing a wide selection of individual retirement solutions. TIAACREF.org/radio. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I wish you a merry, merry Christmas.
On the next Fresh Air, a John Waters Christmas. He's put together an anthology of catchy, maudlin, funny, and ridiculous Christmas records. John Waters is best known for his cult classic Pink Flamingos and the film Hairspray, which was adapted into the hit Broadway musical. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
A happy new year.